And welcome to My Career in Data, a podcast where we discuss with industry leaders and experts how they have built their careers. I'm your host, Shannon Kemp, and today we're talking to Dr. Daniel Parshall.
With a robust catalog of courses offered on demand and industry-leading live online sessions throughout the year, the Dataversity Training Center is your launchpad for career success. Browse the complete catalog at training.dataversity.net and use code DVTalks for 20% off your purchase.
Hello and welcome. My name is Shannon Kemp, and I'm the Chief Digital Officer at Dataversity, and this is My Career in Data, a Dataversity Talks podcast dedicated to learning from those who have careers in data management, to understand how they got there, and to talk with people to help make those careers a little bit easier. To keep up to date in the latest in data management education, go to dataversity.net/subscribe. Today, we are joined by Dr. Daniel Parshall, the principal data scientist at Lakeside Software. And normally, this is where a podcast host would read a short bio of the guest, but in this podcast, your bio is what we're here to talk about. Daniel, hello and welcome.
Hey, Shannon, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Excited to be here and looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, me too. Okay, so let's dive in here. So you're the principal data scientist at Lakeside Software. So tell me, what type of business is Lakeside Software?
Right. So we specialize in what we call the digital employee experience. And the idea is that we are helping to sort of shed light on the darkest state, right? So we help technical teams, IT teams, who might have, you know, many thousands of devices spread across, a large organization. There are going to be constantly issues with, everybody's computer's always got something a little bit wrong with it. And so we help provide the tools to help them identify those issues so that they can resolve them. Because one of the things that gets employees very frustrated is when their digital experience is bad, is when their computer doesn't work, their meetings don't work, you know, their computer is always slow, that kind of thing. So that's really what our focus is. And we really care in particular about helping to identify the silent sufferers. Is what we call them, those people who are, you know, maybe very frustrated with their computer experience, but for whatever reason, they haven't gotten the help they need. And so that's just one of the things, there are a few things we care about, but that is one of the things that we really care about and, where we try and help surface those sorts of insights to the IT folks.
Oh, I love that so much. And so as the principal data scientist, what is it that you do?
Right. So me in particular, I'm doing what we call, I'm helping to build AI that speaks IT. That's our sort of catchphrase for this whole concept. As you might imagine, we have tons and tons and tons of data. And it gets to a certain point where it gets hard to sort of filter through that. And so I am working on, along with our DevOps and our data architecture and engineering teams, on helping to surface those sorts of things. And we're using AI and ML in order to do that, in order to make finding those kinds of things easy so that then people can find resolutions.
Oh, very, very cool. This, I love the whole initiative to make people's lives a little bit easier, because you're so right. I mean, tech is so great when it works and it's so nice, but so frustrating when it doesn't. Exactly. So tell me then, how do you work with data in your job?
Right. So, I've been a few different places as a data scientist. One of the things that is really great about our data here is that it's extremely clean, certainly in comparison to some other places, because almost all of it, it's machine telemetry data. So it's all data that's provided by the computer, basically about the condition that the computer is in. So we don't have a whole lot of those human entered fields where, like, it's a free text field where anybody can just kind of put whatever they want. There are some times and places when that kind of thing is great, but from a data scientist perspective, it's often kind of messy and difficult to use. But because so much of our data is machine generated and generated by our client, so we have what we call a client program that actually sits on the individual devices, and then that collects all kinds of data, and they are very, very, we are very, very, let's say, proud of our very limited impact. There are some programs, and I shall leave the nameless. There are some programs that end up consuming a lot of the machine's resources in their quest to find this kind of stuff. And then that leads to a lot of impacts down the road. So we collect an awful lot of data, but we do so while just sipping at the machine's resources. So we have all kinds of data there. And actually, we are a petabyte scale organization. We have a lot of data. We collect, yeah, we collect, we say 10,000 data points every 15 seconds.
Wow.
And yeah, and that's actually a pretty good summary. Not every single piece of data is collected every 15 seconds. That would be a little redundant. And some data we record, we collect on a cadence more frequent than that and just record it every 15 seconds. But that is a scale we are working on. And when you think about that spread across an awful lot of machines, that's an awful lot of rows of data. And we get into that petabyte scale very, very quickly, but we're distributed across millions of machines. So as you can imagine, that creates some fun technical challenges.
Indeed. And, you know, and just to reiterate the point that, you know, you working with clean data, you know, a problem, I'm sure that makes your job so much easier when you go to analyze it and figure out what you need to do with it.
Yes, absolutely. So having that clean data makes building all those pipelines and things like that. You know, people say data scientists spend an awful lot of their time, you know, munging data, getting it into a condition that you can use it. And that is a much smaller fraction of the job here than it has been in some of my other places.
Yeah, and I bring that up because, you know, as you say, you know, and we'll get into those in a bit here too. You know, we've seen so many and hear about so many AI and machine learning initiatives failing because their data isn't clean. So hence I go into that, bring that up.
Yeah. So often we want to make use of this data, and often organizations have a lot of data, but because that data isn't clean, a lot of it's not necessarily valuable. Or it can be made valuable, but it takes time and effort. Actually, I have a whole little taxonomy of data that I've come up with for presenting to people about, you know, the different ways that data can be bad and the different ways that data can be good and sort of how you can move from one point to the other. But there are some times when an organization thinks, oh, we have a lot of data, we need a data scientist. But really, they need actually a much cleaner pipeline in the first place. And it's not, and you can do stuff with dirty data. Don't get me wrong. But for the most part, models are going to produce, you know, it's a classic, you know, garbage in, garbage out, right? Models, just like any other kind of computer program, or even like humans ourselves, is based on the data that it has.
Right.
And if that data is bad in some way, especially if there's systematic issues, that's one of my big things, then that's going to lead to problems with the output as well. And so I think one of the data scientists' really critical jobs is being aware of those kinds of things and helping to make that clear, not just to like the other data scientists, but helping to convey that to management and upwards, so that then they can help drive things that happen in the organization.
Very, very nice. All right. Well, let's back it up a little bit. And so we can talk about how you got to where you are today. Okay. So tell me, Daniel, when you were very young, say 6 years old, was this the dream? Did you say, I'm going to grow up and be a principal data scientist?
I did actually know that I always wanted to be a scientist.
Yeah.
And so even from a young age, I wanted to be a physicist. Mm-hmm. And I actually did that. I did my PhD in physics. And then spent a number of years, you know, sort of out of as a professional working scientist and basically the equivalent of a tenure track role. But at some point I realized that I was, the things that were exciting to me, I realized that, you know, like some of my other colleagues were reading, you know, physical review letters on the weekend. And by that point I had started reading like the Quarterly Journal of Economics, because I was just getting interested in other kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. Not just the physical problems, but I was really wondering about how some of these things that I had learned sort of applied in the real world. And in a lot of ways, physicists have it really, really lucky because so many problems in physics sort of separate out cleanly. So for almost always, not literally always, but almost always, the electrons don't care what the nucleus is doing. Like, and when you throw a baseball, you're not worried about like the spin orientation of the electrons. Like those things generally don't matter. And so the problems sort of separate out cleanly. And so you can attack a problem at one scale without influencing the other things. And that makes it easier to gain traction on these problems. But it turns out that in the real world, that isn't always the case. And if you implement like a program to say like measure teacher effectiveness, the teachers aren't going to continue doing exactly what they were before you implemented the program. They're going to respond to those changes that you've made. And so separating out those kinds of things is really, really challenging. The economists in particular spend a lot of time and effort on trying to find cases and ways that they can do that. But just this whole idea of like causal inference and sort of figuring out what's really going on was that has always been something I really loved. Even though nobody at the time when I was a small kid said, I want to be a data scientist.
But you always wanted to be a scientist, I love it. I love that. And so, I have to ask, what area of physics did you specialize?
So I did what we call condensed matter physics, which is basically like sort of like everyday stuff, like not astrophysics, which is the stars, and not like nuclear physics, which is like the structures of the the internals of the atoms, but trying to figure out why a lot of material science kinds of things sort of work. So my catchphrase, and we can talk about this if you want to, that I actually think it's very important for people to be able to explain what they are doing at different levels of technical detail. So my one sentence phrase was, I studied how sound waves interact with electricity and magnetism. Mm-hmm. And I like that one very much because people feel like all three of those words, the important words in that sentence, people feel like they mostly understand. And to varying extents, they actually do. And I could leave it at that. But then if somebody was more interested, then I could get into a little more detail. And I could talk about the tool, the technique that I specialized in was what's called neutron scattering. And so we would basically shoot a beam of neutrons at a target that we wanted to study. And then you look at the ways those bounce off. And then you collect the data about where they've gone, and you can infer something. And then if somebody was interested in that, I might talk about how, if you've ever been driving past like an orchard or something like that, if you notice you're sort of driving past it, it all just looks like a really big mess. And mm-hmm. then you get to a certain point where the position you're in lines up with the pattern of the orchards, and it snaps into position and you can see everything really clearly. And then you go just a little bit further and it all becomes a big mess again. And then a little bit later, it snaps into position again, and then it becomes a mess again. And then, so if you were a particularly mathematical kind of person, you might be inclined to say, hey, can I figure out how those trees are arranged just from my position along the highway? And it turns out you can. And that was actually the kind of thing we would do. So you shoot the beam of neutrons in, and then you turn the specimen, the crystal typically that you're studying. And when you get to the right position, you'll get a reflection. That reflection will become a lot more intense, and you can figure out what is happening with the positions of those atoms based on the way those are bouncing off. And then you can get more, and then there's more and more detail they can get. You can actually get into if they lose energy, you measure the energy on the way in and measure the energy on the way out. You know that there was, maybe a sound wave that they were interacting with, and you can get deeper and deeper and deeper. But you can start from that very high level and explain it in, everyday terms, like an apple orchard, right? Mm-hmm. And then dig deeper and deeper as people need to. But the key thing is that you can explain, and I think a genuine way, what it is that you're doing. And so one of the key pieces of advice that I think is going to be especially relevant for your students is that a data scientist can't say, just trust me. A data scientist needs to be able to explain to people, at least on a high level, what's going on inside the model. And why? Because otherwise people are likely to feel like you're trying to bamboozle them or something. And even if they're not necessarily in an adversarial relationship, they still want to be able to understand it well enough so that they can make decisions about it. And so one of the things that's been very useful in my career is being able to explain to non-technical folks the essence of what's going on inside of the model, while leaving out the technical parts that oftentimes a mistake I see junior scientists make is trying to explain a model using the math or using the technical details or something like that. And typically the other folks you're working with, they mostly don't care about that. They kind of want to know what goes in. They want to understand at a very high level what happens, and then they want to understand what comes out and how to act on that. So that is, I think, a piece of advice that's very helpful for the others.
Oh, I love that. So so really early on, so you're in college, following your passion for science. I would love to go down a rabbit hole with you, but to keep to the point of the podcast here, you followed a passion, and you know, as you mentioned, there's many areas of physics to go into. So that's where you landed in terms of your interest, your curiosity of what you wanted to figure out. And then, you know, and data practitioners struggle with this all the time. You know, I talk about this with one of our regular webinar series speakers. You know, explaining what we do is really hard. You know, and, you know, what a data management is, you know, often people just don't understand. So learning, communicating is a skill you learned right away to explain what you're doing, so that you could engage with other people, which I love. Okay. So now tell me, so you major in physics. Now you, where did you go from there?
Okay, so my own research at the time was starting, we were moving from gathering sort of one data point at a time to gathering whole swaths of data points at a time. Uh-huh. And so that, you know, I started working on programs to analyze this and be able to make use of, even as the tools were coming out, you know, sort of the older guard of physicists was still, you know, they were going to these machines that was collecting, you know, bazillions of data points at once, and they were analyzing one tiny little piece of that data. And mm-hmm. I was like, I feel like there's a better way to do this. So I was digging into, can we gather all this data, sort of use all this data at once? That got me interested in computer science. That got me interested in big data. And I was like, oh man, this would be such an interesting field if only this were 10 years ago. But I guess the reassurance I want to offer to your crowd is you can absolutely make that career change. Especially if you're in just sort of a highly technical field, you know, like there are a huge number of physicists turned data scientists. I myself was a little bit nervous about making that transition. So mm-hmm. I talked to a number of different people who had, you know, left academia and gone into industry, and a number of people who had, you know, specifically gone from physics to data science. Like I said, it's a much bigger group than you might expect. You know, basically what I heard from everybody was, you know, jump on in, the water's fine. You know, there obviously there's things that are, no matter where you go, there are things that you like more, there are things you like less. Some of those are individual to the person, but absolutely you can make that change even if you're, you know, in your 30s or 40s. And so you can learn, especially with technical things. Most of us who have been in academia and done, you know, PhDs or things like that have learned to pick up technical stuff very, very quickly. A new field comes out, a new material comes out, something, and you dive into the data and you dig in. That ability is invaluable in any area. And since leaving physics, I've worked in aerospace, I've worked in ed tech, I've worked in entertainment, and now I'm working in IT. You don't necessarily need to know every single thing. You absolutely need to be able to understand on a high level what's going on, but they're going to be domain experts in whatever fields you're in. Like, I worked in aviation safety. I am not an expert in aviation safety by any means, but there were a lot of SMEs, of subject matter experts, that were at the place I worked, MITRE. It's basically a sort of like a contractor for the federal government. It's more complicated. I'll leave it out. But at MITRE, one of the really powerful things that was that we had people who had been in almost every role within aviation. And so my office mate had been an air traffic controller. So when something would come up, I could turn to him and I could get great and immediate feedback from him. So whenever I started approaching a part of the problem that I wasn't quite sure how to handle, there was somebody there who did have that experience. And, you know, obviously he didn't know how to build machine learning models, but with a little bit of us going back and forth, we could figure out, you know, what it is that I needed to understand in order to be able to make my next step. So even if you don't understand, so that's what you can always make the career change. And even if you don't, are not a subject matter expert, you can still work with people who are in order to be able to figure out, in order to be able to gain traction on a problem and move forward.
I love that, being willing to ask others for help and understanding and really leaning on others. And that's great advice too. The willingness to, and the ability to change careers at any time, in any stage of life. And it sounds like it's been a very lucrative, you're enjoying what you're doing now. you mentioned a couple of different industries, you know, so what was the path then as you went from collegiate work into the enterprise business? You mentioned aerospace, then where did you keep going and why did you keep transitioning into the different roles and now IT?
Like a lot of people, when I started getting into this, I worked through some of the Coursera courses. I think the Andrew Ng course is sort of, you know, almost a kind of a badge of honor, at least amongst a certain time period of people moving into data science. And that gave me a lot of the nuts and bolts. I then did a an incubator program that specialized in taking people who already had PhDs. Mm-hmm. And giving them the skills, the additional skills that they would need to transition from being, academics to industry data scientists. That one I did was called the Data Incubator. And I will say that there was a little bit of value in that because when people are hiring a data scientist, they are often, it's very difficult to evaluate somebody's competence in a field that you yourself don't have any expertise in. And so that's why one of the things one of the very useful things can be these accreditation programs. Mm-hmm. So at least once or twice when I was talking to people and I was able to say, oh yeah, it's not just that I've been a physicist and not just that I've written computer programs for analyzing physics data, but I was able to say, you know, I did this specific program for transitioning from data science or from regular science, academic science to data science. And that was often very useful to them because they're like, oh, okay, there's somebody along the way who is able to sort of like confirm that this guy knows what he's talking about in a way that I can't evaluate on my own. So that was helpful. Might not be right for everybody, but I will say that at least a couple places, at least for that first job, certainly mm-hmm. that definitely made that transition easier. I was in aerospace for a number of years. There were actually a lot of really great things about that. That was also enormous scale, like multi-petabyte scale data there. We had our own cluster and the analysis, I think being my first job out of data science, it was a sort of a midway point between the real world. And I didn't really appreciate just how much effort they had gone into making the data clean. They actually had a whole traceability program. So they had all kinds of computer programs that took the original raw data, which was like radar hits, and processed that and stitched everything together and did all kinds of analysis and all kinds of steps along the way. But they had a data management program that, looking back, I slightly drool over. Literally every single data point they had, and I could have something that would like said, when was the moment when the airplane took off from the runway? I could find an individual data point and I could trace all that through that hierarchy, that every single derivative point all the way back to the original raw data hits, radar hits. So they had an inheritance program so every single data point, it was like, what points was this derived from? And then for those points, what points was this derived from? For those points, what was this derived from? In a way that not necessarily everybody needs. It can depend on what you're doing, but in terms of, in terms of me being able to find problems, or when I found a problem and when something looked fishy or smelled wrong, I could trace it back as far as I needed to until I found the place in our algorithms, in our data processing pipelines, where that error had crept in. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of the king of this. I filed something like 100 bug reports in a year. I will say I felt possibly useful to your students. When I first started identifying problems, I felt a little bad because sort of in academia, if you like point out that somebody's paper's flawed, people could be very sensitive about that. But I think software takes a very different approach and, bug reports are seen as a way to improve the product. Right. And if you're good at finding, it's just not, nobody writes bug-free software. So nobody's offended when you say they have a bug. There's that. But if you're able to sort of sort it back like that and figure out, so I find I there's a bug and I think it comes from here, and that can be really, really valuable to people, and they can really appreciate that. So that was the first part. I was in this aviation safety. I heard about this role at an ed tech company. I'd always been interested in education. That was one of the things that I really did like about academia. And so I moved into that role and was there for a couple of years. We were doing some interesting things. The company got bought out and then broken up. And the part I was, a lot of my favorite projects went with the other spinoff. And so that was a little disappointing. So that's sort of impelled me to start looking for other kinds of opportunities. I moved into a role at an entertainment company. On a very high level, we were sort of building meta recommendation engines. So, you know, there's your typical, like, Amazon looks at your past browsing history and your past purchases and things like that to try to recommend what you might be interested in next. We were doing that on sort of a meta level, helping, like, for instance, streaming platforms say, okay, well, here's the kind of customer, here's the kind of market segment you're interested in. And based on the data that we have, here are the kinds of content that you might like to license that would be, you know, so sort of a recommendation engine for the people who are providing recommendation engines, if that makes sense. Yeah, that was a surprisingly technical group. Like, it sounds like it would be just a sort of an easy peasy kind of thing. It was a very, very super technical. They were super smart. And a lot of really, not to sound like a, one of the things that sometimes fairly techies get accused of is being more excited about the tech than the actual work. So I'm going to, at the risk of doing that, I'm going to say, yeah, that the tech stack we were using was amazing. And they're really leveraging a lot of really great techniques in order to do this kinds of things. And I learned a lot about the sort of a lot of the software side of things as well, you know, using, you know, CI/CD and having good unit tests be part of your thing and those kinds of things. The company basically folded when the most recent financial crisis hit and the price of money went up, and they decided to pivot. That was the kind of thing that companies 5 years ago were willing to invest a lot more time in, the people willing to do sort of long time horizon stuff and wait for a while. Let's focus on growth and we'll make profit later. The most important number in the world is the Fed rate. And it turns out that when that goes up, people start focusing on a much shorter time scale. And so they weren't willing to, yeah. So that company decided that they wanted to focus on the here and now and not some pie in the sky research project. So they folded, they cut the entire team. So I started looking for my next position. I found this role at Lakeside, which was a really great mix for me of my sort of soft skills, my love of teaching, my love of finding non-technical ways to explain technical ideas, plus also the technical work as well. And I think one piece of advice that I would give to your students is that if you can, finding places where the data itself is a core part of what the company does is really great. Coming from academia, of course, the point of everything we did was the data. Moving out of an academic role, I was hit rather hard with the realization that other people don't care about the data in the same way that I did. And so that was a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a culture shock thing for me. But that's going to be different at every organization. Mm-hmm. And the more central that data is to what the company does, then the more partly the more contribution you can bring about, but the more buy-in you'll have from management. If you want to do something, you want to make a change, if you have an idea, the easier it is to sell people on that idea. You know, the closer the data is to their core essence. And that's one of the things I love about Lakeside, is that all what we do is collect data and then try to make it accessible. So here we're just now getting into the AI ML sides of things. So from my perspective, it's great. There's a lot of sort of low hanging fruit. There's a lot of easy wins. I think that's important if you're coming into a company, especially when they're starting to just open up that role, is look for some easy wins so that you can get some buy-in, convince people that there is value in what you're doing. And then that'll make it a little bit harder to say, okay, this next thing I want to do is a little bit hard. I need a little bit more, you know, this one's got a longer time scale, but it's, you know, but they've already seen the value that you can deliver. And you've already got that, you know, a couple of wins under your belt. It's a lot easier to move that forward.
Go ahead.
No, feel free to comment on that. There's one thing that I definitely wanted to bring up and add, but we don't need to do that. We can do that whenever you like. I just didn't want us to forget about it.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, I'm going to ask, you know, right now. So this is fascinating. I love, again, this mixed medium of science and communication. You know, what has been your biggest lesson so far in your career? I mean, you've mentioned a couple of prominent ones, but what's the biggest one?
More and more companies are considering investing in data literacy education, but still have questions about its value, purpose, and how to get the ball rolling. Introducing the newest monthly webinar series from Dataversity, Elevating Enterprise Data Literacy, where we discuss the landscape of data literacy and answer your burning questions. Learn more about this new series and register for free at dataversity.net.
I will use this to jump into this problem. So a lot of times people at every level think that sharing insights means sharing data. Mm-hmm. And that is not true at all. You can absolutely share insights without sharing data. And that is one of the drums that I constantly beat, and one of the things that I wish I could shout from the rooftops. So, you know, great example, you know, if you've got, you know, in medicine, you do a study, you want to find out, you know, get more information about how some particular disease works. You can gather a bunch of data about all of your individual subjects, but then you can condense that information and you can write like a scientific paper. And then later on, other researchers can take several of these papers and they can combine the results from all of those separate papers. This is called a meta-analysis. And they can do a meta-analysis and get more insight and nail down the numbers more precisely, get a deeper insight into, you know, how something might work, while still never ever needing to have seen that raw patient data. Me in particular, I've been very interested in the privacy end of things. Mm-hmm. And so understanding that there are ways that you can maintain privacy and in many cases, like mathematically provably, and that comes along with like legal, that meets legal guidelines as well. So that has been huge for me. And understanding, referencing our earlier bit here, that you can't just say, trust me. So being able to find those places where, you know, one of my great finds was a legal article that got a group of lawyers together with a group of computer scientists, and they analyzed what's called differential privacy, mm-hmm. which is a way of, differential privacy is basically a promise that a data holder makes to a potential participant. And it says, your data would be valuable to me if you joined. The more data we have, the better it is. But I understand that you might have your own reservations or all kinds of things that you might be worried about. So I will promise you that I will add noise to any answers I generate. And I promise you that I will add enough noise so that nobody will ever be able to tell if you were involved or not. And so in that case, so it makes no difference whether or not your data record is part of my database or not. So you might as well abuse it. Your privacy will be, and that's the difference in differential privacy, is the difference between that person being included or not. So I promise that I will analyze the situation. Whenever I get a question, I will calculate the answer. I will analyze how much, noise might be needed in order to protect you and every other person. And I promise you, I will add enough noise that it will be, you know, nearly, this is where you get into the math speak, right? Like almost certain, quote unquote, but you can do the math on this. You can make a privacy budget. There's a lot of cool math involved. But it also meets the legal guarantees. And so this group of lawyers worked with this group of computer scientists, and they analyzed it in the context of one specific law. In that case, the law was FERPA, the Federal Education Rights Privacy Act. This is while I was at the EdTech company. So then being able to go to our legal counsel and say, hey, you don't just need to trust me. Look, this analysis has already been done. And so we can do this. We can you know, find a way, because all of our customers wanted to take advantage of the data that all of the other customers had, but nobody wanted to risk their data. You know, so this is very, right. Very navigating that, you know, was an important thing, and being able to show people at all of these different levels, you know, both that this legal analysis had been done, you know, but also I came up with like sort of intuitive explanations, especially where I could give like the meta-analysis example, things like this, being able to explain that and provide those sorts of concerns to people, you know, address those concerns to all of the different stakeholders. And I think that is something that certainly when you're starting out, you don't really appreciate. But I have definitely learned is that so much of what you really need to do is understand what the other stakeholders are concerned about and make sure that you can address that. And that doesn't mean explain it away and say, just trust me. That means you really have to listen to them, because sometimes they have a concern that you really didn't think about. And so when they have a concern, so you really need to listen to people and filter through. I think this is a little bit hard for technical people because we want to express everything in technical terms. And since not everybody else thinks in technical terms, you need to listen to them, hear what they're saying, and try to find a way to repeat it back to them and make sure you understood that concern so that you can really address it. And one of the things that I've done throughout my career is I've basically looked for not necessarily mentors explicitly, but definitely people I wanted to emulate. And there was one guy I worked with who was just great. He would get to a meeting. Everybody, he wouldn't say it. He wouldn't say a damn thing. He wouldn't say a word. He would just listen for about 15 minutes and like let people hash it out, let people go back and forth. And then he would say, okay, I want to pause. He'd say, what I'm hearing is, so what I understand the issue is, or whatever. And he would repeat back to people, here's what it sounds like you're concerned with. You know, and oftentimes I would just be stuck. I'd be like, yeah, he nailed that. So that's one that I have definitely taken and run with and tried to make sure that I could do is this, find understanding the concerns of your stakeholders, even when they're not expressed in mathematical formulas, and being able to address those concerns, you know, in a way that will satisfy them is huge. And that is, I say, what probably the single biggest difference between junior data scientist and principal data scientist.
Oh, I love that so much. So, and I'm really excited to hear your answer to this next question. I ask everybody, you know, what is your definition of data, especially coming from the background that you do?
That's great. I have a lot of thoughts about ways to have problems in data. So data is going to be some sort of information about the world. As a scientist, it's about like these, you know, it's about these materials I'm studying or whatever. As a business, it might be about my customers. You know, it can be lots of different things, but it's some information about the world that you can put together in a systematic way to make decisions and change what you're doing. If the data is never going to change, if you're going to do the same thing anyway, the data doesn't make a difference. Don't bother, right? Henri Poincaré, the French physicist, said, you know, science is built of facts the same way that a house is built of bricks. But a pile of bricks is not a house, and a random collection of facts is not science. So even if you have a lot of data, you have a lot of individual data points, a lot of what we can do is provide the sort of the organization so that you can make a decision based on it, especially in business, what people really, really, really care about. You know, in science, you kind of just, you know, I'm just kind of curious. I just kind of want to know. But in the business world, especially, being able to use data to make decisions is critical. And so that's why I would say it's going to be data, information about the world that lets you make a decision. There's a lot of steps along the way. There's a lot of value add for data scientists along the way. But that's what I see as sort of the key point. And this also points to a whole bunch of places where you might have problems, et cetera, et cetera. But I think if I'm going to sum it up in one sentence, information about the world that lets you make a decision.
Oh, love it. So then do you see the importance of data management and the number of jobs working with data increasing or decreasing over the next 10 years and why?
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to see more and more of this. I think, you know, as companies are sort of like I mentioned earlier, some companies are like, well, let's just grab a data scientist and throw them at the problem. And, you know, as any data scientist knows, if the data is really bad, it's hard to work with. It's hard to get that data from that random collection of facts to that house that you would like to get. And there's a lot that needs to happen along the way. And now I think we're starting to see this differentiation into these different roles. You know, we're starting to see data engineering roles, we're starting to see machine learning engineering roles, as people are realizing, oh, this isn't just one point. There's a whole pipeline of stuff that has to happen along the way. And so I think there's going to be a lot of growth into those roles and a lot of specialization within those roles in order to make that happen. But absolutely being able to explain what you were doing and why you were doing to management in a way they can understand, that is going to be useful for a long time.
Yeah, I don't disagree. You know, and then what advice would you give to people looking to get into a career in data management?
Sure. So I think my mid-30s when I made the jump myself, you know, and at that time, it feels like, oh man, I've invested so much time in physics. You know, can I really do this? So I would say you can definitely make the transition, you know, at any state, even if you're a mid-career person, you can definitely make that transition. And if you're interested in it, and if you find a lot of things fun and exciting, then, you know, then of course that just makes it easier.
Okay. I'm going to add one more question here. You know, you mentioned so much, you know, about the pipeline and the points leading up to the data science portion of things and the AI and machine learning portion of things. So, you know, again, we hear so many stories of, you know, executives saying, okay, we just need to do AI. And then, but we don't need a data model or we don't need data management, you know, and I get people asking me all the time, like, how do I express that? Like, we need data governance, we need a data management strategy before we do all of these things. What advice would you give to executives looking to get into these more advanced technical options?
So I think I like this metaphor, you know, that I had earlier of talking about the pile of facts is not science. The pile of bricks isn't a house. And if you just have a bunch of random bricks that you know, that was just dropped off, at the dump yard, mm-hmm. It's not going to work very well, right? There are a lot of pieces that go along the way. You can, if you have good governance and you can make promises to people about how you will respect their data and their privacy and their, you know, the things that are concerns to them. And that's going to be different for every industry, right? Those are some of the common ones. But the more you can show people that you are taking their concerns seriously, then the more they will trust you with their data. And this has especially been true over the last few years. I've seen a real hard pivot myself from 10 years ago. Nobody cared about what tech giant was gobbling up what. People were like, it's fine. And now people are starting to pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. So I think being able to show people that their concerns about how you're treating their data are valid and that you are addressing those concerns helps build that trust so that you can move forward. So I think that's a big one for C-suites and their customers. I think for the interface between, like, say, C-suite and data scientists, I would say that, just because you have data doesn't necessarily mean you can do something with it unless you're willing to invest the time and energy into cleaning it up. I have a whole taxonomy of like what are the ways data can go bad. But one of the points is if you don't know anything about where the data came from, it's useless, right? If you have a column in your database table that says speed and there's a number there, but nobody can tell you whether that's miles per hour or meters per second or what, you know, then it's useless. And that point in particular led to the Mars rover crash, right? There was one team that calculated the data in miles per hour, even though NASA specifically says in their documents that it must be meters per second, but they just went and did it anyway. And that's especially insidious because the difference between miles per hour and meters per second is about 2.2, a factor of 2.2. So it's not quite, you know, if you see that something's going, you know, 30, you know, in meters per second, or miles per hour, that number is like the ballpark of what's reasonable. So you can't use your intuitive checks about like, I once had a velocity, in our, one of the ones I found in our aircraft data set, I found an aircraft that at least for this one section was reported as having a speed that when I worked it out was greater than the speed of light. And I was like, all right, I don't know a whole lot about aviation, but I can tell you that this is wrong.
Right. Yeah.
But that was one place where I would be able to see a value that obviously didn't conform to reality.
Right. Yeah.
But if you have no context for your data, then you can't apply any of these sorts of sanity checks. And when, you know, and so you can be, at least in this case, disastrously wrong without knowing it. So, you know, I think there is a whole environment that needs to go with that in order to produce, you know, good output, good clean data that then data scientists can build off of. And there, like I said, there's a whole bunch of different pieces that go in all along the way, but being able to build a pipeline that takes the raw facts, the raw little bits of information, and can clean that up progressively so that you can emerge from a haystack with like a nice shining needle of insight.
Yeah, I love it. Oh, well, Daniel, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, if somebody was interested in Lakeside Software, how would they go about finding you?
We are lakesidesoftware.com is our web address. We have products for customers. I think the AI portion is particularly brilliantly designed, but it's mostly a proud parent talking rather than, no. We do a lot to try to sip at the resources, gather a bunch of data, and then surface that up to provide insights that can lead to actions.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. Very helpful and insightful. I really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. And look forward to chatting with you again sometime.
Agreed. Well, and to all of our listeners out there, if you'd like to keep up to date in the latest in podcasts and in the latest in data management education, you can go to dataversity.net/subscribe. Stay curious, everyone. Thank you for listening to Dataversity Talks, a podcast brought to you by Dataversity. Subscribe to our newsletter for podcast updates and information about our free educational webinars at dataversity.net/subscribe.